The Gist. Innovate, scale, succeed.
Valentine Jurgis is an investment professional and entrepreneur. She has a global outlook with a business and econ education from Drexel University in Philadelphia and an MBA from Said Business School at University of Oxford. Val began her career in wealth management at Morgan Stanley in New York. She then later moved back to Nairobi, where she also founded Muradi Fund, Kenya's very first equity crowdfunding platform connecting SMEs to much-needed funding. She served as project director at Centum Investment Company, where she ran a $5 million fund focused on investing in startups and managed special projects within the Centum Group. She's currently the co-founder and CEO of Africa's Pocket, a game-changing wealth management platform that enables Africans to build generational wealth. We couldn't be happier to have Val with us today. Val, welcome, welcome. We're so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here. Finally.
Finally. So I guess we'll just start off small. Could you just tell our listeners who you are? Who is Val Jurgis? Oh, is it even still Jurgis? What do you go by?
How do My you name identify is still, now? Still is Val Jurgis. It is still Val Jurgis. Shall be that way for my life.
No. If you could please just tell our listeners who you are, a little bit about your background, where you're from, etc.
Yeah, sounds good. So whenever I'm asked this question, I start by saying I'm an entrepreneur and I am a daughter, a sister, an investor. And then recently, somebody reminded me to say I'm an Oxonian as well, which is how I know you two lovely ladies.
Yay! Yay.
And I'm an African woman. I was born in Kenya, so that's the nationality I identify with. But I've always identified more as an African and as a woman than my country's heritage. So that's who I am in a nutshell. If I think about my background, so I am an entrepreneur at heart. Like my whole family comes from lines and lines of entrepreneurs up to my great grandmother. So it was inevitable that this is where I would end up. But I took the path of finance investments because, money excites me and money makes the world go round. So I kind of chose a career that helped me understand it more. So spent some time in investments on the wealth management side and on the private equity side. And that brings me to today.
Okay. And we're so happy it brings you today so we could have you here. So I guess you come from a family of entrepreneurs. So did you always know you would want to someday start your own venture?
Yeah, I don't even know if I can say that I knew it. It just kind of was inevitable. When I think about the things that used to excite me, anything that I would be able to do, I would make little dolls and then try to sell them. I would make cakes and then try to sell them. So it was just around me so much. The very first time I made money, I think I was 10. And I stole my mom's eggs from her chicken. She had chicken in the compound. So I took her eggs and I started selling them to neighbors. And it took a while before she realized. And she was so mad. But it's kind of always been like that. I've always been really interested in figuring out how to make a little bit of money. And especially in selling, like helping people solve a problem by selling something to them. So I guess I knew that I would start a venture. I wouldn't say that. I just kind of knew this was going to be an eventuality, if that makes any sense. There's no grand plan or anything like that.
Mm. I mean, I guess there, so do you think entrepreneurs are made or they're born? Because it sounds like you are born. I mean, generations and generations of entrepreneurs, entrepreneurial thinking and a lifestyle just is in your blood.
I don't know. I would say it has to be a mix of both. And maybe it's not the entrepreneur in the way we think you have to go and kind of start a business, but that spirit I think is definitely born. So the idea of problem solving, that wanting to be out there selling things and solving problems, that may be sort of a nature thing, but I do think the skill has to be nurtured. So for me, if I wasn't born into the family that I was born into, maybe I'd have gone and done something creative, but maybe I wouldn't have had the courage to actually kind of venture out on my own. Because seeing my parents build businesses and seeing, you know, how difficult it can be at the beginning, and then seeing what the reward could be at the end is kind of what's pushed me to go in this direction. But the interesting thing is that I think it pushed me into entrepreneurship too early. So Africa's Pocket is my second venture. And for my first one, I was really young. I was 22 starting, and then kind of established it when I was 23. There's so many things I didn't know. And the result is that that business didn't take off. So, you know, if from that perspective, I had to go and learn. I had to go and become confident. I had to actually get some experience to be the entrepreneur I am today. So I think it's a little bit of both.
At the end of the day, I think it's something we kind of, Tati and I talk about like a lot of, obviously during these, during some of these podcasts, really around perhaps you really did need that failure at 22, because I'm sure you've learned so many things from that, from that path as well, right?
So yeah, an intense amount, yeah.
Yeah. That's good to hear. I guess maybe taking it back to sort of Africa's Pocket, what really inspired this particular venture?
So I think to understand Africa's Pocket, you kind of have to understand my background and my career, and because it all kind of comes together and culminates in this venture. So like I mentioned, I've always been interested in entrepreneurship and money, but more specifically money. So I went to school and studied economics and found myself in banking, and I kind of jumped around there. So I was at Morgan Stanley and I did a rotational program. So I jumped around investment banking, sales and trading, and landed in wealth management. And it was kind of mind-blowing to me that there's this career where your job is to literally help rich people manage their money and get, you know, wealthier. It's kind of insane that there are these teams of people who sit down and just think about, okay, this $20 million, how do I make it? How do I protect it? How do I make it more? It was quite mind-blowing to me. Mm-hmm. So even when I went back to Nairobi, I kind of continued in that field. And the thing that stood out to me is that when I went to Nairobi and I was doing wealth management, a majority of my clients were expats. So there weren't a lot of, I didn't have African clients. And even the ones that I could get, you know, it was sort of my parents' friends, a very sort of close network. And it was a small group of people who had kind of, to some extent, gotten lucky and had enough money to need a wealth manager. So that was the first place where I was like, interesting. And then at that point, given my parents, so my parents are tech entrepreneurs themselves, and then I was in the finance side. So there were quite a few people who needed money. And then I still had this network in New York. So I started to connect people with funds. So I would get, you know, angel investors in the US and kind of help them find investment opportunities in Africa. And that opened up this problem for me of you're starting a venture or you're growing a venture, scaling it, and you're having to get money from Europe or from the US or from wherever to be able to actually do something meaningful. And of course, money has culture. So when you get an American investor, it dictates how your business is going to be run because they have certain expectations for return and that kind of thing. So that was the second that kind of went off when I was doing Mradi Fund. And then the next thing that I did after that was join Centum, and we tried to build a corporate venture capital fund. And again, that was really interesting. We had way more opportunities than capital we could deploy, but these businesses were still stuck in how they were scaling. So a lot of them had a very Nairobi mindset or East Africa mindset. And, you know, we know what the population numbers look like. You cannot really get to these huge valuations that we're seeing now if you're only focusing on one jurisdiction. So the third question I asked myself is, why aren't these businesses scaling? So first was, why aren't there wealthy Africans? Which kind of ties into why we have to get money from outside. And then third, possibly if we were able to get these ventures to actually scale, then problem number one would be solved. So I kind of became obsessed with this question for why don't businesses scale in Africa? And that's what made me go to business school to kind of answer that question. And after digging into it a little bit, the thing that became super obvious is that even with this few African people whose wealth I was managing, it was kind of a fluke that they got this much money. People don't actually really know how to build wealth. And so you find yourself in this situation where the whole ecosystem is broken, because the majority of the way that people do build wealth is by building businesses. And in order to build big businesses, you need people to put in money at the beginning. So it's this chicken and egg situation. So after kind of mapping the system, it was like, okay, when we have the most scale and where can we kind of prove two problems at the same time? How can we solve two problems at the same time? The first is solving a problem that a lot of people have, which is financial education. And second is getting these people who get the financial education to a place where they can build enough wealth to keep investing in our own economy. So you kind of start weaning ourselves off of this foreign aid. And so that's how Africa's Pocket was kind of built. That's the basis on which I started to explore this area of fintech.
So what you're basically saying is you're giving us the blueprint to become millionaires in the next few years. Is that what it is?
I hope so. You know, like with all things, we're trying to build a business that goes beyond us. So it may take many generations for us to get there, but that is what success looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, what you've described, like in just the genesis, like the, you know, like what does it take to create wealth? You know, we're not all sitting with a team of bankers that are like literally their job is helping us make money. Like the average person, or even if you're starting a business, you know, your business tends to be subsistence to then just meet your day-to-day needs. Or if you're working, you're like, I don't know, you're living for today. We're not thinking generationally. And so where else would you learn? Actually, I can be wealth building even if I'm just starting a new job. I can be putting, you know, like some of the things that you guys are teaching and thinking about, it's a conversation that people, it used to, like you're democratizing the conversation that used to be held by a few, which I love. I think it's so obvious. And yet it's so like, why has nobody done this? Because we all need it. Like there's like the whole continent needs this in terms of changing how we think about wealth creation and like it's accessible. You know, yes, we're not all going to be Elon Musk. But I love the your thesis and kind of what led you guys to this.
Yeah, it's a long road, but you're right. It's the fact that this information is there, yeah, but it's disjointed or it's behind a wall where, you know, you need a minimum investment of $10,000 for somebody to tell you what to do. So yeah.
Yeah, I think Tatiana speaks so passionately about it, actually, because I think this is a conversation Tatiana and I have so often, right? Especially as like young professionals, we this is a conversation we have all the time. Like, how do we also even build our own wealth and the wealth of people around us and ensure that, you know, there's actually a legacy that you sort of leave there, right? And I think, I don't know if we've cracked it. I doubt we've cracked it, but I think it's the fact that we're always in conversation about it, Tatiana. I think it means it's just something that's really important to both of us as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, Val, like, you know, coming off the MBA, you know, you had so many options at your door. And, you know, oftentimes some people we've spoken to are like, I've got this great idea, like I've got this burning need, but maybe let me go into a job, make some money, and then I'll start my venture. Like, I mean, was that an easy decision to make at that transition point to be like, actually, you know what? I need to do this now. I can't wait a year, 3 years, 5 years until all the blocks are in place. How did you think about that transition?
It's such a good question. I think I was in turmoil for maybe a year. my partner and I talked about it for another year. It was not an easy decision to make. I knew that I wanted to do something. So I knew that because the program was 1 year, I knew that I needed to take a year. I wanted to take a year after that to explore something. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that I would dive into it full time. And, you know, there was a part of me that was still like, okay, actually go back to work and get your, you know, nice paycheck and be in the survey, kind of lifting the average, you know. But...
Oh, those extra surveys. I hope you guys finish. When is the due date for this one?
these days I don't feel it anymore. I'll be bringing down the average. Unless I talk about valuation.
Now we know why.
Valuation is not bad, but salary, I don't know. So it was not an easy decision, but the way that I came to this conclusion was a matter of, okay, so if I go back to work, for me to actually be really good at or to show progress, I need 3 years. And then I asked myself, what if I use those 3 years in building this business instead? Where could we be?
Yeah.
And the opportunity cost of not doing the business was too high, because I felt as though it's something that I can see the path to success. I may not know exactly how to get to the end, but I can see what sort of mecca looks like. And I have the skills to do it. I have the background to do it. And I also think at the time when we graduated business school was such a good time from a venture capital perspective. Being a Black woman in Africa going into fintech, literally there was no better combination of things to try and do. So from a risk perspective, it was also de-risked from that angle. Interestingly, we decided to bootstrap for a while, which I think was a good decision. But still, it would have been much easier to raise funding coming out of a program like the one we went to, being in this kind of space where it was Africa is rising, you know, the tech scene was rising, you know, we're based in Nairobi, which is a city that's known for technology businesses. So those were the things that kind of made me be like, okay, this is the time to do it. And then, of course, as a woman in trying to build a career, I'm like, at some point, I want to have a family. And this is a nice window. When I have time, I don't have pressure, and I can kind of do this, and I can experiment, and I can take some risks before I have to be thinking about other people.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. You said it, right? Like, in hindsight, you're like, yeah, this was the plan. This is why. I mean, it's been 3 years, but I think you're right. I think you're right, though. And I think we were chatting about this before we started recording around, like, just as just being a female in leadership, and like all the choices you're needing to make, but like having this gap absolutely makes sense, and the space to kind of take those risks, but kind of leverage kind of all the blocks that you've got in your hand to take a jump.
Yeah, definitely. I also like the idea about like the fact that about the opportunity cost, because I think that's something people just don't weigh out making this decision. I'm glad to see you thought about it, obviously. maybe just taking sort of a bit of a gear change, for people who don't actually know what Africa's Pocket is, could you just tell us a little bit more of what is Africa's Pocket? What is the business model? What do you do? And how are you going to revolutionize all of our lives across Africa?
That's crazy that I did not start this by saying that. It's terrible CEOing. But,
we also didn't ask you the question, right? We asked you, who is Valentine and Jiroge? What you do is secondary, but who you are is first. So it's okay, not your
choice. I like that. I like that. You're not what you do. Exactly. But Africa's Pocket, we are a wealth management platform, and our goal is to help Africans build generational wealth. And the way we're doing this is by building a platform where you can learn about money, plan for your money, and then also act on it. So we have online courses that start your education. So you start by understanding what are the foundational steps of building wealth. What does your financial plan need to look like? What does your investment plan need to look like? What are your financial goals? So we help you through that. And then on the platform, we've now built in tools that help you now make these decisions in a very practical way. So let's say that you're planning to put down a deposit on a house in 5 years. How much do you actually need to put away every single month? What are the investment options out there for you? So if you're earning a certain return, what will you end up with in 5 years? And so what can you afford? So that's kind of what our tools help you visualize. And then the ACT part is an investment platform, which is coming soon. We actually just piloted our first investment opportunity last week. So what we'd like to do here is kind of curate opportunities that people can participate in. And the hope is that we're able to do this with a Pan-African lens. So eventually we have something that looks like an Africa index fund, that people can just buy into if they want to invest on the continent. And this is really with the diaspora in mind as well, thinking about what does it mean to live outside of home but want to retire back on the continent, and how can you kind of start planning for that? So eventually what I'd love to see is that people come to us with no idea how to do anything, including budgeting. And at the end, they have a portfolio that they can look at and track and understand what they're worth and understand how to pay off their debts and understand how to achieve the goals they want to achieve.
I love everything about that. Like from beginning to end, I can't even like pick up like certain things that I'm better than others. I'm like every single thing. So I guess maybe who would be your typical customer? Age, sort of sex, mm-hmm. Do you still call it sex? But yeah,
who is gender?
Gender, age. Where are you in your life to need an Africa's Pocket?
So when we like started ideating this, we're like, oh, this is going to be for like people who are just entering the workforce and, you know, you've just started earning money. And so you're like ready to make a plan. But what we've seen is that a majority of our customers are sort of in their early to mid 30s. So you find that actually the trigger is less age and more a transition point in life.
Okay.
So you'll find either the person has decided to leave their parents' home, or they're getting married, or they're having a child, or they're thinking about buying a house or going to business school. So when you're making these big life decisions is when people tend to come to us, because most of the time money seems so like such a faraway problem. It seems like a problem for much later. But when you have a decision right in front of you is when people tend to wake up and be like, okay, let me figure this thing out. Interestingly, we have about 70% of our customers are women, which I've always found really interesting. I don't know if it's because the men don't want to say they have a problem or need help or that there are more women or that they, I don't know. I don't know why we have more women, but we do. And then recently we've started seeing a lot of women specifically going into retirement, kind of coming to work with us. Something that I'm starting to realize is that a lot of women survive their husbands. And when you're getting to that retirement age, you realize you don't really know much about how your family finances run, or some of them are widowed. And so we're kind of helping them through that transition of, okay, you're going to stop working soon. How can you make sure that your lifestyle doesn't have to change? And where are they? We actually have customers across 30 countries, which is crazy. A lot of them are East Africans living abroad, but we have started to see, you know, other nationalities come up as well, which is very exciting, and super excited to keep building products that are relevant to everybody.
What you're solving for is so universal that it's different from, like, I don't know, something in agriculture or logistics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to hear, like, we're not tailoring the message, guys. Like, the thesis is absolutely the same. It doesn't matter where you are. Like, fundamentally, the tools apply.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a lot of people who usually ask me, you know, why did you decide to call it Africa's Pocket? You know, you could teach this stuff to everyone around the world. Mm-hmm. But there was intention around making it specific for Africans, making it even to some extent, you know, we started specific to Kenyans, right? Mm-hmm. Because focus is important in entrepreneurship. It's something that a lot of people, it's very easy to like be stuck in shiny syndrome. But the truth is, that's what I understand. That's how my career was built. And so, you know, maybe one day we'll have a global pocket, who knows? But I think it's important to remember the root and why we exist, right? It's to help our economies at home. And so it's important that we have that focus and that almost discrimination to the African context.
No, I get that. It makes perfect sense. I guess you kind of touched on this already, but really currently, what are your growth and scaling ambitions?
So where do I see the company going? For me, it would be amazing to actually have portfolios that are meaningfully made up of African companies, and both in the public market and in the private market. So you see what Future Africa is doing with making venture capital investments accessible and not they're allowing you to get in at smaller amounts, so it's not super risky. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I would want to make accessible, you know, across the board and at scale using technology. That would be amazing. Another thing that would be really amazing is, so right now, if you're trying to make an investment in any capital market in Africa, it is a pain. Like, to buy a bond in Kenya, you physically have to show up at the central bank, which is ridiculous.
Really?
You have to physically be there, and that there's an officer who has to see you sign the paper in person.
Wow. In 2021.
In 2021, this is what you must do to invest in government bonds.
Wow.
So, you know, we're coming from so far.
Yeah.
So being able to just see people, you know, kind of, you know, open up their phone, put in stuff, do KYC online, and be able to participate in our financial markets would be a big step forward. And then kind of breaking the borders around that. So being able to, as a Kenyan, for example, be able to buy bonds in South Africa or Nigeria, and vice versa. That would be the dream.
I love the super commendable. You know, you talked about just hiring just talent. And I guess the question is, you know, being remote, how do you find those people? I think in one of our conversations, somebody called them the crazy ones, you know, to come along this journey with you, you know, like earlier stage in a business's cycle and leave the big established named environment. I mean, like, how are you going about that? Like, because I mean, I'm sure not everybody says yes. Maybe not everybody would say yes, but just how did you go about that, or how are you thinking about that process?
Yeah, it's been quite a shift, actually, because I really had to change my mindset to seeing everyone who comes on early, regardless of how experienced they are, as a partner in this business. Because it's not possible without the, especially like the first 15, 20 people, they're like, it's like a small family, right? So that's the approach that I've started taking. And I'm really trying to be empathetic in these situations and understand that, yes, I'm asking you to leave this cushy job, but I'm also seeing this as an obligation, as a responsibility I have to make the business work. And I've spent time de-risking it. So we're at a point where we have consistent revenue. We're at a point where the vision is very clear. We have customers, we have partners. You know, there's a lot of things that we've put into place so that somebody's not just kind of jumping into a black hole. There is some structure, there is some direction. And that shift to kind of be like, I'm not giving someone a job. I'm having this person kind of come and join me on my vision, and this vision needs to be our vision. So also giving myself room to co-create the future of the company with especially the senior people who come and join us. So it's been a journey. So what I do now is every single week, actually, I spend time messaging people on LinkedIn, through my networks, meeting people here and there. It's like I'm consistently dating. There's a couple of roles that I need to fill in the next few months. And so I'm literally treating it like I am looking for a husband, really. And kind of, you know, scouting.
And we know you did well there. So,
yeah, I have a list, you know, I know where my little fishing holes are and things like that. I'm so glad that this is happening now because the remote aspect is not so... it's not such a big deal anymore. People are hiring remote all the time. People are joining teams that are far away. But definitely for the key hires, one of the commitments I've made is that I'll actually make sure we sit in a room together before we agree to work together. So that's an investment we've agreed to make. It's a commitment that I've made. And, you know, really, at the end of the day, it's so clear that at this stage we're at, because we've been doing this for 2 years now, you kind of can see... you have some predictability in revenue. The next group of people who join us will take us to that next level. So it's useful to see people like that as well. And it's definitely something I didn't have at the beginning. And it's been a big shift in how I think about recruitment.
Val, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you this, right? Because you're unfortunately only our second female guest on the show, but really... what's kind of been your journey as not just a leader, but a female leader? What are the things you've sort of learned along the way as a female leader? What are the things that you've had to I guess you've never not been a female leader, but what are the things you think female leaders tend to have to adjust in their approach and the way they sort of they go about their daily life as a CEO of this amazing new startup?
And I think one of the things, and I think linked to that is, like, you know, is there community? I mean, there isn't a lot, but how have you gone about finding community, and what does community mean as a female leader?
That's a great question. Let me start with the first one. What have I had to, like, what is it like being a female leader? So, like you said, I don't know anything else, but when I see, you know, men around me and kind of what they're able to do that I'm not able to do, I'm kind of like, okay, so that's a thing I have to kind of suck up or I have to adjust. So the first thing I think that I've leaned into is the fact that I am female, because a lot of female leaders want to have male energy, and it's kind of natural because you're taught that that's what works. So you're taught be aggressive, be, you know, very quick with your decisions, be hard on people when you need to be hard on people and things like that. But I've also found that leaning into my feminine energy, if that's a thing, has been so effective. So kind of bringing the empathy forward, and while being assertive, doing it in soft is not the right word, but kind of trusting your intuition when it comes to when are you assertive versus when are you more empathetic in a situation. That has been very effective, like has worked really, really well for me. It's just kind of leaning into these things that are naturally, that I have, that are natural, like intuition. I actually say my intuition is my superpower. And whenever I mistrust my gut, something happens. Marrying the two, analytics plus intuition, for example. I think I've also had to accept that sometimes you do need a man in the room. The industry that I'm in, investment management, asset management, is an old boys club. And sometimes to get in the door, you need sort of a man to open the door for you. And something that my mom has always told me is that she's always had a chairman who trusts her a lot and is well respected in her field. And it may seem, you know, it's one of those pieces of advice that in the beginning I was like, I don't know, must we lean on a man? Like, is this the answer really? Like, why can't we do it ourselves? But you have to choose which battles to fight, right?
Yeah.
For me, I'm like, okay, in some situations, yes, I'll fight for us to have a seat on the table, but sometimes you just need that door to be opened quickly. And so kind of being accepting of there are times when you're going to have to do that, and that's okay. And it's for a greater good, because eventually I will be the person whose door needs to be opened, and it will be better if there's a woman there. In terms of community, it has been challenging, I won't lie. So I remember there's somebody who told me, there's another company that's doing something similar to us, and that other company also has a female co-founder, and both of us were applying to the same accelerator. And someone went like, you shouldn't even bother, because there's no way they're going to take two women in fintech. Wow. And I'm like, oof. And the thing is, it's probably true, right? So it's an interesting space. And I think as the women in fintech, we have an opportunity really to decide whether we want to be a community or kind of see each other's competition. The approach I take is that if I ever see anybody doing anything in my field or even just in tech generally, a woman, I'll reach out. I'll be like, let's have a call. Let's get to know each other. Let's have lunch. Some agree, some don't. And so the community is there, but it does take, I think, a little bit more work to build that trust between female founders, which is fine. And I think what we need to do is just decide to kind of make it a club for ourselves too, because the natural thing is for people to put us against each other. And so you already approach that relationship with that energy, right? So it just has to be a little bit more intentional, I guess, to build the community. But yeah, I lean into it. I think that we learn so much. In fact, the other day, another female entrepreneur called me and asked me about someone who was offering her a deal, who had offered me a deal earlier too. And just because she did that simple thing, and we don't know each other. She actually messaged me on Instagram. We ended up having a conversation for hours that saved her a lot of time, heartbreak, and money. Just because of that simple act of reaching out. So I'm pro-community. I am a big champion of it. But I do think it needs to be a little bit more intentional in when it comes to female founders than I assume the men have to be like. Yeah.
And I also think, you know, the realization that there is enough space at the table. You know, it's not only one female founder or one African female founder. There's enough space and you know, by making the circle bigger, you know that song.
Yeah.
We actually collectively can be so much better. And so that's probably the other thing for other female founders or aspiring female founders to realize and recognize that there is strength in numbers.
There's a lot of strength in numbers. And right now we're so few. Like when you think about the women who've raised venture over the last year, I think Africans, they're like 6.
Wow.
Really?
6. Yeah. Like out of all those deals that have been published, 6.
It's an insane number like that. I may be wrong on the actual number, but it's something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
It's minuscule.
Yeah.
There's so much work that needs to be done.
And there's a lot of room. There's a lot of room for all of us. So that's my perspective. And it's something that I work on actively, kind of making sure that there's a space for us.
Yeah. So everyone, please slide into Val's DMs and Africa's Pockets DMs.
Please do. Please do.
I mean, I guess Val would love to hear from you, I guess, for our listeners, for kind of aspiring entrepreneurs, female, but also male people looking at fintech. What is your advice? Like, what are three things that you would give as advice that you've learned or you are carrying with you going forward that you think, you know, everybody who is looking to build a business, a venture in a business on the continent should be thinking about?
Three things.
Or it can be 5, but you know, the consultant says 3.
The consultant says rule of 3. Let me stick with 3. So I think the first thing I would say is if you already know you want to start something, just start it. It takes so much longer than you expect. And it is much harder than you expect. So do it while you're young. You know, this is the youngest you'll ever be, and start as soon as you can. And then hang in there. So, you know, it's for me, it's been transformative to do this with a co-founder and with a group of people around me who are encouraging me, because there are so many times when you're like, man, I should just go to work and get that paycheck, right? Because it is difficult. And there's a lot of times when you get stuck. And I think it's especially difficult when you know what the future can look like, but you cannot see what the next step is. So you see what 100 miles away looks like, but you don't know what the next step is. That's usually for me the hardest. And in those moments, your community and the people you surround yourself with are extremely important. So it's useful to pick those carefully. The people that you share your journey with and the people who keep you going. So that's the second thing. And I think the third thing that I would say, if you start with the wrong person at the beginning, man, I don't know how solo founders do it. It is so difficult to do it on your own, like power to those guys. And I understand why so many startups fail, because the founders don't have the same vision. So I would say spend an outsized amount of time understanding the vision and making sure that people who come on board are aligned with that vision, because that's your North Star. That's what keeps you going. And if you find out down the line that you want different things, it can be pretty detrimental. So, yeah, I think I'd say those are the three things I would say.
That's perfect. That's perfect. I love the metaphor of a North Star, actually. I think I'm going to steal that and use it going forward. our film.
Yeah, that is correct. Well,
I guess, I mean, yeah. Well, from my lovely co-star, Tatenda and I, thank you so much for coming on. Yes. We look forward to having you when you reach unicorn status back on the podcast.
Yeah. From your lips to God's ears, girl.
Amen. Amen. And maybe you can throw us some shares, like some French shares, because, you know, we had you on the podcast when you were your first few years.
Maybe that's my third piece of advice. Don't give out equity for free, man.
Yeah. No, but it's a good point, though. It's a good point.
Why are you like this? I'm actually trying to make a case for both of us.
Wealth creation, not wealth donation.
Protect your equity.
I'm here for it, Val. We must invest. We can't.
It's true.
Asking for free.
I'll remember this, Tatenda. I'll remember this.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, thank you so much, Bell. This has been such a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank
it
you.
Was fantastic. Asanteni. That means thank you for non-Swahili speakers.
You are such an inspiration, Bell, and we are so excited to keep seeing what you're building, and just a bigger, wide table of African wealth holders. We're excited.
I love it.
The Gist is creating new African narratives through disseminating key lessons and best practices from some of the continent's leading entrepreneurs and businesses.